Hi, folks. This is CBD at the Cut Gym Newsletter, worldwide broadcast system. Sefton is at a family lunch today, so he's bailed on us. But instead, I got a much, much better person, and that is Joe Mannix, the co-blogger from Ace of Spades. Most of you have read his very, very good stuff. One of the things that I enjoy about him is his relentless logic when he approaches problems. Whether that's good in the grand scheme of things, it remains to be seen. I think a little bit of emotion and anger is probably a good thing too, but let's start with logic. So please welcome Joe.
Thanks, CBD. I'm incredibly flattered. Hopefully I'll live up to it. I appreciate, as always, the chance to come on with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let's cut to the chase. There are a bunch of things going on in the world right now. I think that Israel's strategic goal in Gaza and how that seems to be shifting is an important one. So let's start with that. Joe, I know that you followed the war after the October 7th pogroms very closely. So I'm just going to drop it in your lap. What do you think Israel's strategic goal is, and is it changing?
I don't know. And I suspect we'll find out in the near future, because the strategic goal that Netanyahu has stated has, one part of it has been very clear. The other part has had, for me anyway, a lot of question marks around it. Like, how do you hope to achieve that? The first part and the clear part is the utter and total destruction of Hamas and the personal retribution against all those responsible for October 7th. So that part is fairly contained. And the fact that Israel has not capitulated to Western pressure, primarily American pressure, to not go into Rafah leads me to believe that they are committed to that particular strategic goal. And I think that they'll be successful, at least generally successful in that. After they finish purging Hamas in Rafah, I wouldn't be surprised if they do some targeted assassination abroad, in places like Qatar and Iran. So that part, I think, is probably well in hand and not changing. The part that has some question marks around it for me is the second part of what Netanyahu and the War Cabinet have talked about rather a lot, which is, to borrow language used in the middle of the last century, the whole never again part, right? This will never be permitted to happen again. Another Hamas will never be permitted to rise. And that, I don't see a way to accommodate that without at least a couple of generations of full-blown restrictive, probably the right word to use would be ruthless, military occupation of what is now called internationally the Palestinian territories. So that is where the question marks are for me, both is Israel willing to do that, and is Israel capable of doing that in a vacuum when the West finishes disentangling itself from Israeli affairs and Israeli alliance? So that's how I see it. I think the immediate goal of destroying Hamas and slaughtering its leadership personally is still the goal and still achievable. It's the more distant parts that have me curious as to what they plan, because I don't know. I only see the one way to do it. That doesn't mean that's the only way to do it. I'm not a military strategist.
I agree with you for the most part. I think there are two issues. Well, let's say the first issue is that I don't think that the IDF is planning an occupation of Gaza. What I think they're doing, and I'm not the first one to think this, by the way, there's a guy on X or Twitter named Andrew Fox who has laid this out. But I think that what they are doing is simply degrading Hamas's ability to wage war against Israel to such an extent that they will be nothing more than a poorly armed and rather scared police force within Gaza. The IDF is rapidly destroying all of Hamas's infrastructure. And interestingly enough, it seems like they are creating a bit of a buffer between Gaza and Israel proper. My guess is it's going to be a demilitarized zone where nobody can go. It'll be actually no man's land. I don't think Israel has the patience to allow even one terrorist attack across that border. And whether and if that means that Gaza loses, 25 square kilometers along its border, well, tough shit. The second thing is, I don't know that it's possible to cleanse Gaza of the what is essentially militant Islam. That is what Islam is. They want to destroy the Jews. The West is next, but the Jews are first. I don't think that Israel can do it. Even after this incredible destruction that Israel has wrought upon Gaza, the people of Gaza want Hamas back. How can you fight that? I think the only way to deal with that is simply to isolate them, prevent. What Israel needs to do is prevent gun running and and weapons movement across the Egyptian border, and let Gaza do what Gaza wants.
This is why I, like I said, there are a lot of question marks around it for me, because building a DMZ and isolating what's left of Gaza, is probably achievable. Where the challenge that I see on that is one, and you mentioned it, that would also have to include enforcing a DMZ with Egypt. Egypt might have something to say about that. It might even be a good thing. Egypt doesn't want to deal with this problem either, at least most of the time. But Egypt might have something to say about that, and it would put Israel in the position of having to occupy a DMZ. That couldn't be a no man's land with Egypt. And in a way that is not physically contiguous with the other DMZ that they're running. That's logistically very tricky. Without something like a Danzig corridor between the two, which is, I suppose, also a possibility. The other is a DMZ is still vulnerable to the air, and Hamas has plenty of, or has the ability to build, or has had the ability to build in the past, air capability. It's not sophisticated, and it's not accurate. But that didn't matter on October 7th. It was good enough if your goal is not strategic. If your goal is to break the border and go kill people, that's relatively easy to achieve. And I don't know that that would be a long-term solution. And if there is a long-term solution, we can find it in the ancient world. So to your point, is it even possible to denazify, to borrow that language, Gaza? The answer is yes, it is. It happened semi-routinely in various theaters throughout the world, prior to the modern age. It's just so ruthless and so bloodthirsty that most people don't want to consider how to do it. But Rome did it to Carthage. It can be done. It basically involves killing half or more of all fighting age men, taking their women, and colonizing them. That's a big blood price to pay, that most people are not willing to pay. And that may not be a bad thing, but it does mean that you are in this constant containment strategy.
I well, obviously, I mean, you're talking hypothetically, and Israel will not do that. We both know that.
No, they won't.
Yeah,
Yeah, no, they won't.
that's
And
so. But the thing is that Israel has wonderful examples of how not to do it. I mean, we tried in Afghanistan, and that failed. We tried in Iraq, and that failed. So manipulation of the internal culture, the internal policies of Gaza, I think is a recipe for failure. I think that this is going to devolve into simply, if you cross that line, we're going to kill you. Other than that, do what you want. And then, of course, Israel will send regular search and destroy missions into Gaza to make sure that that little bomb making factory gets blown up, or that little rocket factory gets blown up, and in the process, the four bomb makers get blown up. But absent a sea change in Islam, I think that's all they can do, and I think that will be, I think that will work.
Yep, as long as, yeah, and if that's Netanyahu's strategic goal, permanent containment, let's call it, for lack of a better term, or a term I know, it can probably work until the Israeli government says, this isn't really worth it anymore. And then the process repeats. But then again, I suppose that's the human condition.
Well, Israel survived between 1948 and 2024 without this sort of an attack. So that's the time frame that we're looking at. History tells us that's their time frame. Will it happen again? Well, as you point out, governments change. And what is the primary goal of a Netanyahu government might not be the primary goal of a Joe Smith government in 40 years. But I think for now, the Israeli people have come to the realization that there cannot be any kind-hearted dealings with the Palestinian Arabs, the Arabs in Gaza and let's face it, southern Lebanon and the West Bank. And they have to do something different. And they're doing something different right now.
That's the other strategic aspect of it, where truly punitive post-war treatment of Gaza, which is largely what we're talking about, is, will that act as a disincentive to Hezbollah and ISIS, who are very happily and busily fighting their own civil wars in Lebanon and Syria? And will it give pause to Hezbollah and Fatah in the West Bank? And it might. So far, they haven't engaged, not seriously, which has surprised me.
Yeah, I mean,
there might be local issues.
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. Hezbollah is, firing a couple of rockets. They're killing people, which is bad. They're firing some anti-tank missiles, launching a couple of rockets. But by no means is it the large-scale attack that they are capable of. And the same thing in the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority has very little authority, unfortunately. It's a bunch of clans and cliques that decide what they want to do on their own. But what they're doing is very, very disconnected from any larger goal other than, let's go kill some Jews. And they're not very good at it. So it's going to be interesting. But I think that what Israel's doing now is by and large, the correct course of action.
Yep. I am inclined to agree, especially on that initial well-defined goal. This is the first time I've seen Israel not back down to American pressure.
Agreed.
So that's notable. I think that is the real sea change.
Yes, 100% correct. So let's move on to the United States. So Joe and I have discussed over the last couple of years what really needs to happen in the United States to tamp down inflation. And anybody who's ever taken Econ 1 realizes that inflation is caused by government spending. So how we're going to fix that is a question for another day. But at this point, what is the Fed going to do with interest rates? There have been noises that they're going to cut. Certainly the American stock market is very interested in the idea and has had a significant run-up in the last week or two on the hope that those interest rates will be cut. But I think it's pretty obvious from the data that we have that interest rate cuts right now are a bad, bad idea. In fact, Joe and I have talked about how they should probably be going up instead of coming down. Joe, what do you think?
Yes. beyond that, I took the position, I think it was back in December, when Jerome Powell went on TV and hinted that there might be interest rate cuts next year. that it wasn't going to happen, that we would see at most two. Symbolic gesture rate cuts of 0 to a quarter point. I still think that if there are to be rate cuts, which would be the wrong thing to do in every dimension, that's what it will be. It will not be significant, and they're going to go right back up. But I also am, based on the way the inflation data have been coming in, for, well, really since the beginning of the year, but especially in the last month, month and a half, 2 months, is I am no longer even necessarily betting all that strongly on symbolic rate cuts, because the consumer price index, even beyond the machinations that are going on with that, like removing coffee from the CPI, is still way too hot. And even more importantly, the producer price index, which is, depending on the goods involved, is usually between 1 3/4 upstream from the CPI. So it takes time to filter through, right? Because produced goods have to be sold, and that doesn't happen instantaneously, is in pretty rough shape. And it's had three that I can think of off the top of my head. I think I have that right, about three really nasty prints in a row. So the CPI is not going to get better because the producer prices are baked into the cake, and it takes several quarters to shake out. So PPI is still hot. CPI is going to remain hot and probably get even hotter. And cutting interest rates into that environment is at best pushing on a string, and at worst, compounding the problem, and more likely compounding the problem. So this brings up from it would be irrational to cut rates. It would be absolutely reckless. So the question then becomes, well, will the Fed do it anyway? Because the Fed is a political animal, and of course that's why we wait and see. But I don't think it's going to. In the past, the Fed has a very long history, its entire history, in fact, of playing politics and making bad decisions in the name of political expedience, right up until the moment comes that they're about to lose control and destroy the dollar. Once that threshold gets hit, the Fed defends the dollar and has a long history of doing this. Election years be damned. They weren't able to help much in 2004 when the economy started to slow down and there was the whole Bush Bucks thing. It wasn't, or rather, that was 2007, excuse me, which was an election year. It wasn't able to stop the housing crisis. It wasn't able to stop the Bush 41 economic decline because of the S&L crisis and various other things. The Fed has a long history of playing politics until it can't, and when the chips are done it down, it defends the dollar. And I'm going to bet that they stick true to form, at least as long as Jerome Powell is there. Now, when Powell's tenure is up, if they put a purely political party animal in as Fed chair, all bets are closed. But right now, Jerome Powell is far more of a Fed traditionalist, and I think that he's going to hold the line. I don't know that he's going to be eager to increase rates as much as we need that, but I don't think he's going to make good on those intimations from last year that he might cut them.
Well, that's good news. I didn't expect you to say that. I expect Powell to behave much more like the political, the typical political animal. And I think that the reality of the election in November is that Trump has a reasonable chance of winning. Will he win? I don't know. If I had to bet, I'd bet no. But there is certainly a non-zero chance that Donald Trump will be the next president. So the destruction, the further destruction of our economy by cutting rates will dump the vast majority of that damage squarely into Donald Trump's lap if he wins. So I wonder if that's not part of the political calculation.
It surely is. But I think it's a different calculation. So Donald Trump is going to get a lot of the, it, let's assume he wins. So actually, no, let's not. Let's assume next president, whoever that is. The next president is going to have a lot of this dumped into his lap anyway, interest rates be damned. We haven't solved the underlying problems. We haven't solved the deficit spending, which is a huge problem. We haven't reabsorbed all of the monetary emissions from the COVID stupids. And we can no longer play the game of hiding the problem in overseas trade flows because those are shrinking. So no matter what, the next guy is going to get a big steaming heap of economic trouble. It doesn't matter whether it's Trump or Biden, because a lot of this transcends specific administration policy. The specific administration has an effect, but ultimately the power of the purse is in Congress, and it refuses to cut a single penny of spending. So, and there's a whole lot of stuff well outside of politics, global trade, and everything else that those chickens are in the process of beginning to roost. So no matter who's in the big chair next year, this is all coming anyway. And that might actually temper some of what the Fed actions will be. I'm not certain that it will. They are party affiliates, but the so much of what's coming is probably unavoidable without a significant amount of pain. You might remember from the Euro debt crisis, austerity became the word of the day, and it's going to become the word of the day again. So, given the inevitability of that, might make the Fed a little bit more pragmatic, but it's all speculation.
Well, I think that if Trump does win, he has one very, very nice and very easy tool to use, and that is releasing the American petroleum industry to pump more oil. And oil is a very, very nice thing to have in an economy because it is essentially cash. What we're doing is harvesting cash from previously unused reserves. And it has a wonderful ripple effect in the economy because it cuts the price of essentially everything. But absent that, I don't know what other tools Donald Trump would have at his disposal. I don't think that he is going to be a fiscal conservative. He can
Well, he never
certainly,
has been.
yeah, I it would be it would be contrary to his 75 years of experience. And I don't know that, well, I certainly he can decrease federal regulations and so on and so forth. And the change in tone might have some modest effect on the economy. But I think that you're right that there is a shitstorm coming, and there isn't much we can do about it, no matter who is in the White House.
So there, who is in the White House, assuming he actually has any power? So let's go ahead and take the blue sky assumption that Donald Trump wins and he actually has the ability to do something. So I don't know how true that is, but it's a good enough basis for speculation. There's actually rather a lot that he could do to help, rather a lot. Oil and oil production is certainly one of those things. The regulatory environment is one of those things. The trade environment is a really big one, in building incentives for American production, or at least penalties for foreign production.
Okay,
There's a
let's
lot of
discuss that.
things that could happen,
Okay,
but is that enough absent deficit, absent controlling the deficits? I don't know. I don't think so. Sorry, go ahead.
no, I apologize. What can he do with trade? He's a big fan of controlling trade using tariffs, which I think has its place. But I don't know that it's going to be able to drive the entire economy or even a significant portion of the economy. I think it's mostly a message rather than a something that has a significant effect.
doesn't need to drive most of the economy. So with the kind of industrial decline, especially lower in the value chain. So a lot of people like to talk about, and they're not wrong, want to be clear about that, that American industrial production has actually been improving over the last several years, and that the value of the overall industrial sector has been getting higher, and employment has been going up, and the number of enterprises has been going up. That's all true, and that's all, in fact, very good news. It is, however, also all at the higher end of the value chain. Lower value industrial work, true assembly line work, for example, is still not doing all that well. The more sophisticated it is, the better we know how to do it, and the more efficient it is for us to do it at home.
So we can build chips, we just can't build coffee makers.
No, more like we can build industrial automation controls, and we can build high complexity items that involve a lot of automation, but we don't build most of the input components to those same things. And where trade policy, I think, could really help there is if it's fairly well targeted. There are some incentives to onshoring production, or there are specific disincentives to continued offshore or offshoring of production to specific regions, namely East Asia. That will probably help. But I think most importantly, there are other things that aren't strictly speaking related to trade. There are things in, say, the tax code that currently incentivize offshoring or continued foreign operation for domestic companies that could be changed. Now, that is something I generally don't like, which is using the tax code specifically as a behavior incentive tool rather than a revenue tool, but it would be an option. None of this without consequence, of course. But trade should be a part of our diplomatic toolkit. And Donald Trump is the first president in decades that understood that, right? Trade is an effective incentive, and it is also an effective weapon when it comes to wider diplomacy. And he's the only guy in recent memory who has been willing to treat trade as anything but unrestricted free trade, no matter what. It's off the table as far as diplomacy goes. And that also sets an important tone that if trade is back on the table for diplomatic purposes, and we saw this with the first Trump administration during, say, interactions with Mexico and during interactions with Korea, that it will change the incentive structure for American enterprise, which is we have access to this world market. We like participating in this world market. We don't want to depend on it in its entirety because diplomacy reigns. So there's a lot of subtle, potentially silent side effects. But I don't know if I actually answered your question or not. And it's also all wild speculation anyway, but I can see a couple of things there.
No, I it's very interesting. Let me back up a little bit. My first thought, is using economic policy as a tool of tradecraft, of foreign tradecraft. Where the hell am I getting this shit? Of foreign policy is dangerous because
yes, it is.
As we see right now, let's face it, the Ukraine boondoggle is essentially foreign policy being manipulated by the hundreds of billions of dollars that American companies are going to earn by selling them arms, and of course that 10% cut for the big guy.
Also a great example of when this goes wrong, right? We were supposed to, we being Ukraine and her allies, which includes the United States, were supposed to win this war through sanctions, and it failed.
I don't want to talk about Ukraine, but I'm going to talk about Ukraine.
Yeah.
The idea, and I've been beating this drum to death, but the idea that this border dispute has anything to do with the United States, or for that matter, Western Europe, is ridiculous. You know, Ukraine and Russia have been fighting for hundreds of years. They hate each other for the most part. Pushing Ukrainians into Russia to take over land or pushing Russians into Ukraine to take over land is a tried and true method, and they've been doing it for years. Well, this time, Russia's winning. Why we are involved, I have no idea. Why it matters in a, on any significant geopolitical stage, I don't know. This is a, I think it's NATO's last gasp, trying to remain relevant in a time where NATO simply is not important. And of course, the horrid and very, very obvious graft that is occurring. And let's not forget, though, that Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And that's saying a lot because, you know, look at most of Africa. That's very, very corrupt. Look at most of South America. Very, very corrupt. But Ukraine gives them a run for their money. And that's really impressive in a deeply disturbing way.
Yep, with friends like these.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's stay with the United States and talk about what I think is probably a tactical error on the part of Donald Trump. He has agreed to debate the mushhead in chief. I think they've agreed to two debates, essentially accepting the Democrat Party's restrictions on those debates. I don't know why Donald Trump is doing this. I don't think it makes much sense. I don't know that it's going to be destructive, but I don't understand it. And maybe you can help me because I just don't get it.
I don't know either. I can, if I try to think through it, by, I think where the Democrats did something quite skillful on this is I can see the argument that these terms suck. They really do. And they should be rejected. And I agree with that. They sort of trapped Donald Trump with this. This is one potential explanation. The media landscape being what it is, the Democrats were shrewd in putting out their demands first, right? And so if Trump rejects it and says, no, I won't debate you under these terms, then it becomes Donald Trump refuses to debate the great Joe Biden. And if he says, I won't debate you on these terms and here are mine, then it's Donald Trump will only permit some showpiece debate that favors him, which is, of course, exactly what Joe Biden is doing, right? There's no illusions about that, at least not with me. But that's the person who put out the demands first gets to control a lot of the narrative, especially when there is already a narrative control engine in place, which we have. So Trump might have seen it, and it might be irrational or not, I don't know, but Trump and his team might have seen it as, well, shit, now we have no choice. We have to do it. They got us. They trapped us. And I don't know if there's anything to that, but I think there might be. Or the other is Trump doesn't much care. He plans to go up, say his piece, let the people make their own choice, and who cares about the spin? He might view it as a non-major event or a non-major threat. I can see either of those possibilities. There's certainly at least half a dozen others. It's I don't know quite what to make of it. What I can make of it is that in a remotely honest, even remotely honest media environment, the demands that the Biden team put on the debate structure are so absurd that nobody should be able to even read them with a straight face, let alone call them fair. But that's where we are. The other piece of it is this is the first time I can think of in my politically active life where the presidential debates are not being done within the framework of the presidential debate system. And it might be that that's being viewed as a long-term win. They let Biden say, yep, we're going to get rid of these rules that we've been demanding for decades and been developing for decades. We're going to do new rules and we're going to negotiate it independently. And that very well might be the end of the classical presidential debate system. And it might be that that's viewed as a price worth paying in order to get that. Don't know.
I think that's actually, I think that's a net positive for the United States, because the debate system was a joke. It didn't work. And I think that two candidates should be able to figure out some reasonable way to debate each other. But what I think Joe Biden has done here, or his handlers have done here, is taken RFK Jr. off the stage. He's not even discussed. And that suggests to me that the Democrat Party is concerned about RFK Jr. pulling votes from Biden rather than from Trump. As for the reason why Donald Trump got bamboozled here, and I think he did a little bit, I think it's just more of his bombast. He just wants to be the guy who says, absolutely, I'm gonna eat your lunch at the debate no matter what, and I challenge you to a debate. And I don't think he thought it through. I think that you're correct. I think that the Democrat Party won this round. The question, of course, as you've already asked, is so what? You know, how big a deal is it going to be?
Yep, no idea. But
yeah, it'll be interesting.
It's one to watch. Yeah.
Yeah. So before we started this podcast, Joe suggested a very interesting segue from debates, and that is the government get out the vote systems that have been funded at a ridiculous rate over the last several months. It is obviously a way to manipulate the vote in November. There's no rational way of seeing it other than that. But the amount of money being pumped into these quasi-government, quasi-private organizations, and there are hundreds of them, is quite amazing. And the goal, of course, is to subvert the will of the people by manipulating the vote. And I see no other way to see it other than that.
Yep, I agree. I think it is a naked and public effort at of manipulating the vote. And a naked and public effort at manipulating the vote. I mean, and that's what get out the vote drives are for, right? Is take people who aren't politically engaged, get them to be transactionally politically engaged, and vote the way you want them to. That's the whole purpose of a get out the vote system. And it's mercenary, and it's, I think, a little bit dishonest. That said, it is what it is. And that's the rules. That's how it works. Where the really new thing in this is the government directly funding this at a very large scale, and funding it in a way that guarantees that only one kind of person gets registered. This is, you know, these quangos, quasi-NGOs, are all left-wing affiliated, and they are largely urban focused. They're looking to run up the totals in urban areas they already control and where they have very easy operations in order to prevent states from swinging the wrong direction. It's all incredibly targeted, and it's all fully progressive or fully Democrat or fully leftist or whatever hell word you want to use. And it's being done with taxpayer dollars. This is the real problem. Get out the vote itself has its problems conceptually, but hey, all's fair in love and war. But the direct government funding of it in such a limited and narrowly focused scope is openly, to borrow the left's language, it's a big threat to our democracy. It's, you know, the U.S. federal government and the party that controls it engages in vote buying and has been for generations. This is just direct vote farming on the taxpayer dime. And it's probably illegal. Not that that matters. But it's yet another little Rubicon that has been crossed, and it's going to keep going. This is going to be a forever fixture from now on, and it's just another thing that anyone who wants to try playing to win in elections for as long as they think that's relevant is going to have to contend with from now on.
Well, sadly, I think you're 100% correct. And I think that they are probably going to focus on the what I think are going to be the battleground states, with the data that I have right now. That is that Donald Trump can probably take Georgia, he can probably take Arizona, and he can possibly take Nevada. I think that will give him 267 electoral votes. Maine is a lost cause. They used to split their electoral votes, but they changed their law, so he won't get anything out of Maine. And if he does, I'd be shocked. So this leaves Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and possibly New Hampshire. If Donald Trump can take any of those states, oh, actually, Virginia, too. I forgot about Virginia. If Donald Trump can take any of those states, then he will win the election. And I think that the Democrat Party is going to focus on those states. And I think that that is where the true battleground will be. And you described it, I think, as underhanded. I think that you're being polite. I think this is about as sleazy a thing as anything that has happened in the history of the United States. And the fact that our erstwhile opposition party tolerated this is unbelievable to me. And I think that it is proof positive that they are, in fact, part of the Uniparty, that we do not have a principled opposition in either of our houses. And I think that until that changes, we are going to be in a lot of trouble in this country.
At this point, CBD, I'd be willing to settle for unprincipled opposition. Any opposition at all would be all right. And yeah, I think get out the vote in its modern form is generally underhanded. That said, no, this direct state party sponsorship of it, with money that they don't own, because it belongs to the people via the government, is not underhanded. I think it's incredible. I think it's disastrous, and it's probably illegal, but we're also post-law, so legal
Yes.
arguments don't matter.
Yes. The idea that the federal government is involved in any way with getting out the vote is offensive to me. Where they derive this authority is beyond me. It's simply not in the Constitution of the United States. But as you pointed out, we're beyond the law. It doesn't matter at
Yeah.
this point. It's
They said
how they
they
want to
have
spend
it.
the money.
Yep, they said they have it, so they have it.
Yeah. Well, that's cheery. So let's drill down a little bit. I love that phrase. It irritates the shit out of me. And let's move to the left coast. Now, California, I wrote about this today on Ace of Spades. California is, I think, going to retire the trophy for the most fucked up state. And they are demonstrating it. I think what they're trying to do is run up the score at this point. They are trying to eliminate diesel-powered trains in the state of California, which I think is one of the most fascinating things on earth. I used to work at a company that dealt with rail freight. A fair amount of its movement was across the rails in the United States. And folks, we have an amazing freight system in this country, and it's driven by diesel electric locomotives that are wonderful machines, incredibly efficient, unbelievably powerful, and they run great all across the United States without any extra infrastructure other than, they got to be fueled up every couple of days, and that's about it. But California, in its brilliance, wants to transition to zero emissions trains, which means, of course, electric trains run by overhead power, exterior power, external power, or battery-powered trains, which is even more problematic. Joe, have at it.
So when we look at the press release from this, from CARB, it's hilarious in how unsubtle it is and how the rationalization in the minds of a California regulator works. So I want to read to you one passage from this. And keep in mind, when they talk about emissions, they're talking about NOx, nitrous oxides, which you can make an argument either way for if you really want to. But I want to read to you one little excerpt from the press release for this. Currently, operational emissions from just one train are worse than those of 400 heavy-duty trucks. To further underscore the impact of locomotive operations in California, emissions reductions from the new regulation are expected to be equal to almost double those emitted by all passenger vehicles in the state between now and 2050. Do you notice what they did there?
Oh yes, it's lovely.
This isn't even sensible. It's worse than those of 400 heavy duty trucks. Well, you're going to need more than 400 heavy duty trucks if they have to haul trailerized containers around switch yards because battery powered switch engines aren't up to the job, for one thing, or for when rail freight in California goes up in price by some huge amount. 50%, 100% more, search me. Retrofitting that kind of infrastructure ain't cheap. And that will force more onto trucks. So you're actually going to end up negative on NOx. But even if you set aside, that sort of second order effect, what I find interesting is the bait and switch right there in two sentences. So operational emissions from just one train are worse than those of 400 heavy duty trucks. Okay. I'll take it at face value. Notice that they don't quantify it, but that doesn't matter. Let's assume any is bad. Fine. But then our expect the emissions reductions from the new regulation are expected to be equal to almost double those emitted by all passenger vehicles in the state.
Now, what the hell exactly? What the hell that has to do with anything is beyond me.
That's right. The first comparison is probably pointless, but at least sensible, right? Trucks haul freight. Trains haul freight. We can make a comparison on that basis. Notice how they didn't, after they set that basis of it's the equivalent to 400 heavy trucks. When they talk about emissions reduction, they no longer use that same baseline. They use passenger vehicles, most of which are gas instead of diesel, and most of which have negligible nitrogen oxide emissions. It's not even subtle. It's just this is how the insane rationalization inside the minds of a California regulator works. It's shocking. And what's also fascinating is this looks a whole lot like a handout to locomotive manufacturers, because part of this, and I very stupidly closed the tab where I had it referenced, so I'm going to estimate it, is they put a maximum age on the locomotive fleet. It, I think it's 23 years, if
Yeah,
I'm remembering
23
it
years.
correctly. So,
Yeah.
this sounds like, I don't know, do they do locomotive manufacturing in the state of California? Because that sounds to me like it might be a part of it. It's not even just about emissions regulation. You also can't have anything too old. Old is, of course, bad. We all know that. It's the effect of this, because CARB does this kind of shit all the time, pardon my language, where they are an old
Folks, my work
agency and
here
they
is done. I got Joe to curse. This is great.
have this weird relationship with the EPA, where when California wants to do something particularly insane, the EPA has to approve it, and the EPA is going to approve this, and would be my guess. And that leaves those in the market with a choice. They can make one of three choices: either make everything CARB compliant and make it really expensive, but you can sell it in all 50 states. You can make something not CARB compliant and have it be a lot more price competitive, but you have to sacrifice the California market. Or you do both. You have a CARB compliant version and a non-CARB compliant version, and you get to maintain twice your supply lines and infrastructure and SKUs and all of that.
Yeah,
So
which is and awful. No,
in
no.
reality,
Good.
Oh, yeah. In reality, all three of these things happen. It depends on the market. For something as expensive as a railroad, It's going to be door number three. They're going to have the California compliant stuff and the outside of California stuff. And if they decide to do this, I don't think this one's going to result in nationwide change, not unless the EPA mandates it, which is always a possibility. What's going to happen is your freight rates inside California are just going to skyrocket. And it will factor in the form of higher prices for goods everywhere in the United States because of those massively busy and productive ports on the West Coast. And some of that freight will shift to other ports, like maybe in Washington or Long Island or New Orleans. But there's only so much freight, there's only so much port capacity. So anything coming through California just got more expensive.
Well, it's also
You're
possible
welcome,
that
America.
yeah, it's also possible that and this is what I would do is instead of using short haul trucks to move from the port of Long Beach and the port of Los Angeles and Oakland and so on, wherever they're unloading containers, moving them to the rail yards, that quick jaunt, they'll put them on medium haul trucks and move them to what will probably be new rail yards in Nevada.
Yep.
Yeah, probably Nevada.
Massive freight depots.
Yeah,
Yes.
so
Massive freight
it,
depots in Nevada and Arizona.
yep.
Yep.
And so all you're doing is, as you pointed out, you're just going to move the freight from efficient trains to inefficient trucks or less efficient trucks. But let's say that they can produce the infrastructure to electrify California rail. When you think about it. By the way, folks, I don't have this off the top of my head. I'm looking at a screen right now. So, a typical locomotive, the big ones that you see, I'm not talking about passenger locomotives, but the freight locomotives they start at about 4,000 horsepower, which is about 3 megawatts.
Line haulers, yeah.
Yeah, the big ones. And listen, you pull a mile and a half train and you put four or five of those on there. So, there's a company called Wabtec. And they build electric locomotives, which is very, very impressive, except that their maximum output from their batteries w is 8.5 megawatt hours. Now, to push a train using 3 megawatts and you only have 8.5 megawatt hours, th that seems like you might have a little trouble recharging your batteries. To cross California, or to move from the Port of Oakland down to Southern California or into Nevada. And
And
that is the cutting edge technology as we speak.
yeah, and they also won't, right? So this whole thing is about zero emissions trains. It's about electric trains. It's not about battery trains. So the only way that this could be conceivable is that the battery powered trains are used, battery powered engines, locomotives are used only in areas where the infrastructure cannot be electrified with fixed resources. So things like switch yards that are too complicated and don't have the space, or heavy industrial or heavily developed areas where they can't afford to buy land to put electric infrastructure
Can you
over
imagine
the
running
rail.
electric
And
power heavy enough to run trains through Los Angeles? I mean,
yep. So what you will find if they do this is most of the intermediate, medium, and long haul rail infrastructure in California will be fixed electrified. They're going to run electrical gantries over all the rail. In areas where that's not feasible, they're going to have to do engine switching. They're going to have to switch on battery powered engines and haul them through the non-fixed areas and then switch those engines out and put them back on fixed power. And I think the ideal vision for this, if there is one among these lunatics, is, well, battery powered locomotives are only going to be for classification and yards, switch yards, things like that. Otherwise, it'll be fixed overhead power. And when things move to the edge of the classification yard and go out on the road, they're going to be on different engines, but they're on different engines anyway because they don't put switch engines on the main line. And
And then, of
that's
course, they're going to switch them
probably
at
the
the.
vision, if I had to guess.
Yeah, but they're going to switch them at the border as well, because.
That they will.
So, just think about the added complexity. Ah, hell, that screw the complexity. Let's assume the infrastructure will be built. The added time.
And not to mention the hundreds of billions of dollars, if I had to guess, worth of electrical retrofitting for the main line is, it's preposterous. The fact that they're even considering it shows a complete disconnect with reality and what appears to me to be an incredibly arrogant God complex to the point of being outright hubris. It's fascinating to see. And the EPA is probably going to let them do it. So I guess we'll see what happens over the next decade.
That scares me. The fact that you think that the EPA is as insane as the California Air Resources Board. That's terrifying to me. All right, folks, we are reaching a hard stop. Joe, do you have any last words? Do you have anything even more ridiculous than electrified trains for California?
No, I'll just leave it with the hope that I don't have last words for a little while.
Well, Joe, thank you very much for joining me. It has been a pleasure. Please come back as often as you can. Sefton, he has some health issues, as many of you know, but I expect him to be back and ready to go as soon as his doctors say, "Well, you can start talking again." Anyway, folks, thank you very much for listening. Joe, thank you very much for joining us. And until next time, this is the Cut Jib Newsletter Podcast. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thank you.